Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello one and all, and welcome to Behind the Glass, the podcast which aims to take you behind the scenes of the YouTube channel Seen Through Glass, as well as the automotive and social media worlds. I'm your host, Sam, from that YouTube channel Seen Through Glass, and apologies for the slightly weird intro. For those of you watching here on the YouTube channel, hello, you've probably noticed I'm back in my living room, scene of many lockdown podcasts. For those of you listening, you may have picked up on the fact that this sort of audio quality is not as good as it usually is when we're in the studio. The reason I'm recording this here and now is because I totally forgot to record an intro the other day when I sat down with Ed Lovett from Collecting Cars for today's episode. We met up at Collecting Cars HQ and recorded in a rather echoey office, but I don't think it really matters because the chat I had with him was fascinating. If you followed me on Instagram or Twitter over the last, I don't know what, 6 to 9 months, you'll know that I quite regularly post cars that become available through the Collecting Cars website because there's always like really interesting, juicy bits on there. And I wanted to understand kind of where the idea had come from and where Ed came from, because last year I appeared on the Collecting Cars podcast with Ed and his co-host, a small motoring journalist called Chris Harris. It was a huge amount of fun, but yeah, it felt about time that we flip it around and I get the Collecting Cars, Ed from Collecting Cars, onto my podcast. So I really hope you're going to enjoy this. As I say, I really did. I found him such an easy guy to chat to, a really nice guy to chat to, with some amazing stories and opinions on the sort of automotive world. So yes, if you're watching here on YouTube, make sure to subscribe, turn on notifications. If you're listening, keep listening wherever you are listening. And a quick shout out to our amazing patrons. Sit back and I hope you enjoy. Ed, welcome to Behind the Glass.
Behind the Glass. Behind the Glass. Thank you very
much. I feel like we're evening the score because I think most of my listeners will know, but maybe some people missed it. I appeared on your podcast, the Collecting Cars podcast, middle of last year.
Indeed.
With Chris Harris, who you co-host that podcast with. And it was great fun. I really enjoyed it.
It was very good. I think we did it in my house.
We did do it in your house, which was also lovely. But today we are at the Collecting Cars office, HQ.
HQ.
As all the branding would suggest.
Thank you. Get my hat on here.
I will say before we started recording, Ed did have a cape, a Collecting Cars cape that he did want to wear like a football hooligan, but I talked him out of it. Or maybe he realised himself it wasn't the best move. But look, this is a super cool place, but also business, and I want to get into it, you know, in today's podcast. But I actually want to talk a little bit more before that about you and your story, because you didn't kind of just happen onto this business by mistake, and it's not your first dabble in the automotive world. So let's kind of start roughly at the beginning. You choose when the beginning is. How did you get into cars in the first place?
I was born into it. I was born into it. My grandfather started Dick Lovett in 1966. And yeah, so I guess from the moment I was born,
you had no choice.
It was clear it was going to be cars. I did think at school I might be an architect, but my teacher told me I was crap at maths, so that wasn't going to happen.
Uplifting teaching
And I was definitely not going to be a sportsman either.
Okay, I can sympathise though. I empathise. But therefore, why are you not running Dick Lovett the group right now?
That's a very complicated.
Sorry,
I
don't want to go deep, my question I thought is: Did you try and work your way up through the ranks? Did you do some hours at showrooms?
No, I've spent most of my working career working with my family business and certainly with cars. For whatever reason, I don't think I'll go into all the stories.
That
now,
could be a whole nother podcast.
I probably don't fit the corporate environment. and restrictions put in place by manufacturers. I'm my own person and have my own voice.
Fair enough. And growing up around that huge, I mean, I'm going to call it a conglomerate because, I mean, Dick Lovett, my audience will be very familiar with because I seem to be filming there every 2 weeks at the moment. You know, so many different brands and things like that. But were you looking at it, or were you talking about it as a business? I mean, where did it help with the passion of cars because you were around them, or was it just, oh, that's what dad does or granddad does, he just buys and sells cars?
No, I think as a boy when you're growing up, you know, we all get into cars quickly, and the fact that you know, my father has always been a racing driver, always come home in nice cars, it's impossible to avoid it. Where I'm probably slightly different is that I'm a dealer. I am a dealer at heart. So it's as much about the deal as the car. So, you know, I don't, when I was going to work, I've started at the bottom washing cars, body shop, parts department, workshop, admin, and then got into sales and very quickly found my feet and what I enjoyed doing and what I was good at.
Do you think you could now buy and sell anything? Do you think you've got an inherent dealer inside you, not just with cars?
Yeah, probably. You know, I'm not saying I'm very good at buying and selling. It's what I like doing.
Sure.
But it doesn't make it any easier if I like doing it.
Because I don't think I could. I'm not a salesman. Like, that's the one thing that I've always been aware of. Like, if I track my career history, it's very much been on the sort of fluffy side of business. Because I'm not someone who can just like get deals. And even with my own cars nowadays, like, I'm always handing it over to some specialist rather than trying selling it privately, because, you know, I just don't have the balls to do it. But I think if you are a salesman, sometimes those skills are quite transferable, and someone who can sell cars well can probably sell paintings or jewelry. I mean, I don't really know, but that was my assumption.
Yeah, I think, you know, obviously you can sell something. Certain things are easy to sell because if everyone wants them, then it's easy. But it's about people and people skills. Sure. And funny enough, I don't think my people skills are actually that good.
They're fantastic.
In many ways. But when I can engage with someone who wants to buy something, you know, we find a level. And I think that's important. You can find a level with lots of different people.
And there's a thing with petrol heads, which I guess is why, you know, especially if you're passionate about what you're selling, but cars in general, is I do feel like we can all connect on any level. You know, you walk into a room, if it's a stuffy dinner party, and I talk about this a lot, if there's one other guy at the table who's into cars, you're kind of saved, because you know, it doesn't matter if he's into 1930s Bugattis or whatever, and you're into modern day stuff, you can still click and connect, thank God.
That is true, although there is a negative side to that, because if they know you're the car guy, even the girls, all they want to do, what car are you driving? You know, what have you got? What have you sold? You know, what's your favourite car? And my wife hates it. You know, anyone who comes to our house for lunch, you know, within seconds of arriving, what's downstairs? What have you got?
Interesting. What did you see that GTO sold the other day that they read about in the Telegraph?
and you think their wives will start asking my wife about, you know, what? That's a lovely dress.
It's a lovely handbag.
Where are you going on holiday? They're more interested in the cars as well.
So cliched. Well, look, you touched on it, so I'm now going to jump on it, because you have owned some pretty amazing cars over the years, personally, and I guess through business, like, you know, stuff going down. And downstairs, right now, you have a very interesting car, which is a new 911 Speedster.
Yeah.
The GT3 Speedster, which I love the look of. We were speaking about it before we came up to record, that weirdly, I feel like it's kind of gone a little bit under the radar, that car. I don't know if because Porsche just haven't had many people drive them. They're obviously super limited, but it feels like there are a ton of them on the market, which you never really want to see with a car that theoretically people want to get out and drive. But how are you finding it?
I love it.
You love it?
I really like it. I didn't buy it new. I had to pay a premium for it. And it's a slightly funny story, because it was that particular car I wanted. Not any Speedster, but that one. And on my birthday, which is the 18th of February,
send me a card,
put it in your diary. I made an offer on that car.
Incredible.
Significantly more than I paid for it. And when I made that offer, I was said, the owner doesn't want to sell it to a dealer. And I was like, well, I'm just, you know,
that's horrible.
Money's money. And I bought it.
Well done.
30 grand less.
Well done.
Three
Congrats.
Months later.
I love it. Yeah. Amazing. So are you a Porsche guy then? What particularly about that car?
Were you desperate about?
Am I a Porsche? I definitely am a Porsche guy. You know, you can see through international collectibles that, you know, it's mainly Porsche, Porsche, Porsche. And there's a few reasons for that. I think Porsche as a product and a brand is, in the collector car world, is the most liquid. Everyone knows what they're worth, give or take. You know, if you price it right, you'll sell it. You know, if you're an owner, if you've got one, there will be someone out there to write you a check for it. And I really like that because I don't like sitting on inventory for a long time. I hate it, and that's why collecting cars is. But we'll come to that. So I had a Singer 911, which I ordered new. Went to California with my wife to collect it the last week she could fly before she gave birth to our second daughter, whose birthday is today.
Oh, by the way. Congratulations. Happy birthday.
And so we really love that experience and owning that car and also driving it without ever thinking about whether it's going up or down in value. And that's another thing for me with Porsche, you can do that. You know, fine, if you go and do 20,000 miles in a speedster, it's worth less than a car that's done 1,000 miles. But the point is, you can still sell it.
Sure. Well, I hope you're right, because some people out there do 30,000 miles in Carrera T's and try and sell them. Who knows who they are, but fingers crossed they can get rid of them. Yeah. But no, you're right. There's something about that Porsche mark where, as cars to drive and live with, they're fantastic. You have that semi-security in the fact that, yes, there's always an audience or a market out there for them, but they're cars that take miles well.
Yeah.
I mean, being a Ferrari obsessive, you know, not with my 360, because I consider that I will try and keep that car until I'm 95. But, you know, otherwise, I would always think, oh, I can't really, I shouldn't take it on that trip, or I shouldn't do this, because I'm just screwing myself over. With Porsche, I feel like it's the opposite.
Yeah.
It's almost celebrated the more miles the car has.
So I was speaking to a client of mine this morning because we're trying to sell one of his cars to a guy in America. And the guy in America can definitely afford the car. And we've got to the point where it's too much about price. And you just get on and buy the car and start making memories. And with the Speedster, we bought it during lockdown, so I couldn't collect it. Had it delivered into London. We weren't in London. And when we came back, my wife went back to Cornwall. And I stayed here with the Speedster and then drove it down to Cornwall, which was great. Pissing down with rain most of the way down there. Aquaplaned about six times on the M5, almost killed myself. And then the weather turned whilst we're in Cornwall. And my wife and I went out one evening and we parked on the beach in Damer Bay in the Speedster.
Wow.
Heaters on. Coffee and actually those, I'll remember that, whether I sell it or not, I'll remember it because of that. And when I drove back from Cornwall, it was totally the opposite weather, heat wave. It had just been Father's Day, so my daughters have bought me some mini dime bars, which I like dime bars, by the way.
You demolished in about 20 minutes.
Remember for my birthday.
Well, 18th of February?
It was, yeah, exactly. Yeah, okay, but because it was so hot, I got back to London and they'd melted everywhere.
Oh my God.
Anyway, I like memories in cars and the Singer, 15,000 miles, 3 years, I'll have so many memories of that car. And the speed is the same. And it doesn't really matter about the value or what the car is. It's about creating memories in a car.
And I think, you know what, you and I share the same thought here, where I totally with you. It's all about what you do with these cars. And also, it doesn't always matter what the car is. Like, I have some amazing memories from my first car, which was a Mark IV Golf, you know, like just a 1.4-litre banger. But I have amazing memories with it. But I'm not someone who's sentimental about keeping the car for the memories. Like, a lot of my audience were upset when I announced I was selling the Carrera T, because they're like, how can you part ways? But those memories aren't going anywhere. That trip still happened. I don't need the car in my garage to get it and go, ooh, it still smells like Latvia. You know, like I don't need that. But are you the same way? I get the feeling you're the same way.
Well, yeah, look, very much so. Just very quickly on the first car thing. I did see Shmee the other day, found his first car. I wonder how many of us, our first cars are in the same status as...
Honestly.
I know mine is. I had a Nissan Sunny 1.4 LX with a rear spoiler, and I fitted a mini disc player.
Hello, mini disc.
Someone we know in the family had an accident, so we got newer cars because we are car dealers. And
sure.
My mother wanted us to have cars that had airbags in them, so we got newer cars. And my cousin took the Nissan Sunny 1.4X and destroyed it.
God damn it. It's almost a rite of passage, though, for first cars. They need to have some kind of awful sort of, you know, ending. I don't know. The problem is I don't know the original plate of my first car because I'm a douchebag who's always had private regs that that make no sense because, you know, this is who I am. And so I can't track down where that first kind of up. Mine was a Halfords special because it was a bog standard 1.4 Golf and I just took it to Halfords and put chrome everywhere. Chrome strips literally that would stick down with sellotape on the grill. So I had a chrome grill and different alloys. And so if the Nissan, was it? Was yeah. your first car. What would you consider was your first sports car, or at least the car that you were like, yeah, this is cool?
Well, I'm working for Dick Lovett. I drove great cars.
I can imagine.
They were the company's. They weren't mine. Do you want to know what the first new car I bought was?
Please.
A Singer 911.
Really? Yeah,
correct.
That's amazing.
That's not true. Sorry.
Okay.
Scrap that.
Total lie.
Scrap that. Rewind. The first new car I bought was a 991 GT3. We moved abroad.
Okay.
And I had the first car in the market, which was total fluke because they told me that the first cars you couldn't have lift on. And I was like, I don't care about it. I'll just have it. And ended up, I could have lift on it.
Sure.
And so it's just a bit of a scam, basically.
I took
delivery of it, went for a drive with my wife again. And 3 days later, I had a call from the Porsche Center to say, stop driving your car. There's an engine fire problem with
course.
A GT3. And it was parked four stories down under a building. And they came to pick it up and said, you can't drive it. And I was like, well, fine. Send the tow truck down yeah. four stories down
what
the building.
What are we going to do? Oh, my
and,
God.
And, yeah, 4 months it took me to... I didn't even want the car after that. And I just got my money back after 4 months.
What was that like, though, having been around cars for so long? Obviously, yeah, buying, using it. Because I've never bought a car from factory. I've never gone through that spec and waiting and blah, blah, blah. So was it rewarding? Like,
do you know what? I think that the fact I had 400 miles in it and couldn't use it really pissed me off.
Sure.
So I went to the Porsche Center, paid them the deposit, gave them the spec, and it was quite an important moment. I remember collecting the car with Viv, so it was quite important. Subsequently from that, though, and I don't know if this was the peak of the change of that type of market, which I'm sure we'll come on to, but you know, I went back to the dealer to say, I'd quite like a GT3 RS next, is
sure.
that all right? Oh yeah, we've got so many orders, and not
you
sure
need to
we can
bed this Panamera first.
Yeah, all of that, and set you know 911R, GT2 RS, and I was like, I'm not flirting with any car dealer. You know,
I
won't even flirt with my family business to get a new car. I'm not going to play the Ferrari game. Mm-hmm. I just won't do it, and that's why I went and bought the Singer because
interesting.
Whilst everyone was buying GT3 RSs and flipping them and no one was using them, I thought, I'm going to go a totally different route. I'm going to go for a Singer. And that's what I did. And okay. so that car for me was a really important purchase. Yeah.
It was almost a middle finger to like the mainstream manufacturers, basically. Because you're right. I mean, I feel like it's almost softened off a bit just because I think now manufacturers are making so many of these theoretically limited runs that the cars are more accessible. For example, I got offered a slot on a 718 GT4 the other day when I was like, well, okay, fine, I bought two Porsches, but nothing that special. And how many are you making? Because I feel like there are already thousands on the market. And my one question was, if I want a 992 GT3, do I have to buy this car now? Because I don't want it. But if you tell me that, then, oh, God, the whole thing is horrible.
Yeah.
That's my thought process. But I just suppose that's the way the world goes. But yeah, so your Singer was kind of like a bit of a, I'm going to go my own way.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Correct, yeah.
And you sort of said we're going to move on to it. Let's move on to it a bit because alongside collecting cars, you're still running International Collectibles, right?
I am. I'm very much so because, you know, collecting cars is a startup, although gathering momentum very quickly. But I still do have a lot of core clients globally. And it seems a shame to not continue to service them in some way. It doesn't take up a huge amount of my time. I don't take much crap from buyers or sellers. So, you know, I like to deal with nice people, buyers and sellers. I focus that when it needs the focus.
Well, again, my audience will be familiar with that because I got absolutely trolled when you posted that insane white Challenge Stradale a few months ago during lockdown. And I think it looked like about 350 people had tagged me on that post. And I was like, people, leave me alone. But it's a good example of the kind of cars because I would say that whatever you post, and maybe there's stuff you don't post, it's always kind of interesting cars. They're not generic. You know, you either have interesting specs or things that you don't see all the time. And is that because of the stuff that you enjoy at selling, or is that just because of the clients that you have?
No, it's just, you know, I'll only sell what I want to sell. So it's as you say, you know, it's, I look for interesting things. What one thing that is changing very quickly, and that white challenge style is the perfect example, but things have escalated a lot since February for collecting cars. None of those cars I would list now on International Collectibles. I'd put them on collecting cars because
my, and
I don't want to jump ahead, but as I said, I don't like to advertise cars for too long, and collecting cars is a way of selling cars in 7 days. So why should a challenge Dali be sold in any other way than via collecting cars? There are some cars that, being that they are more expensive or a bit more special and it takes time to find the right owner, that perhaps collecting cars is not the right environment for them at the moment. I've got a Zagato Speedster I'm selling for a client at the moment. It's a very rare car. It's a very expensive car. The owner is not, it's not a fire sale, so we're not just going to go and stick it out there and, you know, bid what you want. It's going to take some time with a car like that to find the right owner. We've got a Jaguar D-Type, which is the same.
Okay, so yeah, the specialist stuff still needs that kind of handling, doesn't it? And the right customer and the right client.
And finance, part exchanges. You know, there are reasons why you can't just do a quick, let's get it sold 7 days.
Move on. Well, yeah. That, oh, look, it brings us perfectly on to collecting cars. We might as well come on to it, because I think, you know, people have been, or at least I feel like people have been aware of what you've been doing since kind of launch, because there's been some interesting moments here and there. Obviously, the podcast has been super successful. And so sort of awareness has been rising. And then again, we spoke about it before we started recording, but I feel like over the last few months, things seem to be on a real upward trend. And I'm noticing more and more incredible cars. Like the cars that are being listed on the website are really exciting. You've always had cool stuff, because I've always posted on stories and stuff like that. I'd be like, oh my god, look at this, is so quirky. But it feels like, you know, 812 Superfasts, and that's a really good example because I just saw it the other day. But interesting stuff. And of course, there was the 720S, which you had during lockdown, which kind of shocked everyone, I think, with theoretically how affordable it was. So for those who have no idea what we're talking about right now, just give us a sort of elevator pitch of what collecting cars is.
So it's pretty simple. It's a free to list and sell platform for sellers, where we host an online auction for 7 days with a professionally written description, which is about the car, not the model. Highly detailed description.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And then we also have 100 to 200 photos. So if we say it doesn't have a curved wheel, you'll see a photo of all the wheels. If we say there's no wear on the driver's seat bolster, you'll see a photo of the driver's seat bolster. So that transparency and information, where you've got 7 days to sit down, ask the seller questions, go and see the car. It's just doing it quite differently to auction houses, to traditional car dealers. It's changing the way people buy and sell cars.
And I think you're right in when you were saying sort of maybe initially it was a fire sale type, you know, I just want to get rid of the car, stick it up there, let's just see what happens. But I feel like now it's a really interesting and viable way to sell your car because it's got this audience of, you know, enthusiasts, people who are looking for cool cars, quirky cars, good deals, etc., without the kind of dealer inflation or the messing around or whatever it might be. It feels like it's got rid of a lot of that. Yeah. So I definitely keep my eyes on it because you've had cool car. You had the 695 Abarth 70th Anniversario. Very interesting car for me. I love that thing. And on the used market at the minute, they're still up at like 28, 30. And I was like, are they worth that? You're sold, I think, for 26. I was like, okay, well, clearly that's just where they are.
Yeah.
But then, you know, you do get some other things which come in a bit low. And I go, oh, hold on a sec. Maybe there's an opportunity here. So that's why I think, it, you know, the credibility seems to be great, gaining a lot. So how do you acquire cars for the website? Do people approach you? Are you out there looking to get cars?
So that's changed again. So our first auction started on the, just remind myself, 14th of May 2019, 3 days before my third child was born.
A lot
of my stories are attached around my children. Nice. So we started then the first auctions ended on the 2nd of June, because when we went live, the first lots were up for 2 weeks. And I'm not sure if you remember, we had 270,000 mile 1989 911 Speedster was one of our early lots. So in the early days, podcast, Instagram, hi, we're here, consign with us, a lot of cold calling, Piston Heads, Auto Trader, car dealers, Car and Classic, we've seen your cars for sale, can we help you, do you want to do something a bit different? And we had a pretty good pickup straight away.
Sure.
You know, expectations, we were trying to manage our expectations in terms of not thinking we're going to have world dominance immediately. And then getting to around Christmas time, you know, we had general elections, you know, so there were some sellers in the market that were becoming a bit more motivated. So sure. That helped them thinking, right, what's the quickest way for me to sell the car if dealers aren't writing checks out? So collecting cars became more prominent. And then it was really from February this year that we started to see an increase in incoming inquiries. And obviously, as we arrived in lockdown, you know, we get about 25 incoming consignment requests a day.
Wow.
And a lot of them we turn away, you know, because we're probably not the right place to sell a 196,000 mile 320 diesel BMW. although if there is a 320 diesel BMW that's interesting, we will still run that. So we obviously number plates we've been offering, and we get a lot of pretty rubbish number plates offered to us, so we turn those away. But we've got, you know, we've got 100 cars, just over 100 cars live on the site at the moment.
And do you feel like, so for my US viewers, they'll be very familiar, I think, with Bring a Trailer. And is there a slight differentiation between what you and Bring a Trailer do? And then secondly, do you think this is kind of going to shift or is shifting how some, you know, some people are buying and selling cars? Because I think definitely the market is changing, at least in the supercar or the interesting car side of things. And so I can see why people would want to come through you a lot more, you know, with the cars that they're trying to move on from. So yeah, let's talk about the Bring a Trailer thing first. For those people who don't know what that is, it's essentially a similar setup in the US.
I would say it's almost exactly the same.
Okay, yeah. Okay, so yeah.
And they've been at it for quite a long time. I think they've just sold the business to Hearst Media on the 23rd of June. That they, you know, it's an incredible business. You know, they did, I think, circa 10,000 cars last year, $230 million worth of transactions. It's an incredible business. They are chasing volume. We would like, and we are increasing our volume, but we're still pretty focused on quality, that mix. We're not throwing anything on there because we just want to make as much money as possible. You know, we are picky. And because we want the right people to engage with our audience, and that doesn't mean the right people because we just want to be selling 488 Pistas.
You know, sure.
We want, you know, a Mark 1, a Mark 2 Golf GTI. You know, we want the odd motorbike,
cool quirky stuff,
number plates at £1,000. You know, plus we do want the big stuff. You know, that's where our model really comes into its own is cars sold over £100,000. So any car that sold over £100,000. The buyer's premium is £5,000 plus the VAT.
Okay.
At a traditional auction house, the buyer's premium on that would be £12,500 plus the VAT.
Wow.
Plus they charge the seller as well between 5 and 10%.
Okay.
So we're saving the transaction from buyer and seller a considerable amount of money. Take that to £1 million, and they're paying £150,000 worth of fees. It's £5,000 with us.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. So yeah, it becomes very attractive for everyone involved, really. And I think you're right in the sense of interesting cars and selecting them, because I'm not the only one who's basically reposting what's listed almost every week, because there's always something to catch my eye. But of course, Chris Harris as well. I think we're in a sort of Twitter competition to who composed more interesting lots or listings on Clayton Cars. So how did that relationship start? How do you and Chris know each other? So
I've known Chris for 25 years, give or take. And I remember him turning up at BMW Bristol back when the E46 M3 was launched. And no, before that. So Z3 M Coupe, etc.
Oh my God, okay, amazing.
And Chris would take me out for a spin around the corner in it just to show me what this press car was like. And we've always talked. And Chris is a proper diehard car nut, and he's everything from Peugeot 205 to 250 GTO, which I think is the expression we used in our first podcast with Max Gerardo. So when I decided I was going to do this, I engaged with Chris very quickly, not to say, can you come and help me? More like, this is what I'm going to do. Do you want to get involved? And he was like, yeah,
sure, let's straight
do
away.
It. And I think I was with him having lunch the other day, and that telephone call, he was walking to Edgbaston to watch the cricket. And
oh, wow.
He still remembers the call, and I'm pleased I made that call.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you know what? Especially on the podcasting side, I think, you're lucky that my co-host isn't here this today. Goddamn, Tony. But it's really important to do these podcasts with people that you're used to just talking with cars about. And I guess that's what seems like when I listen to your show with Chris, you just come across like two guys who are having those conversations anyway.
Yeah.
And I think that's the thing with me and Tony, we're talking throughout the week about the stuff. We just then record it at the end of the week. And so you have that natural flow with him, right? Where over the years you've just been chatting cars.
Exactly. Yeah. The podcast, to a certain degree, is Chris's domain. He sets the tone of that. Chooses the guests.
Often gives you quite a hard time.
Gives me quite a hard time. But no, but it's important because when we sit down, we don't want to be trying to get blood out of a stone. It needs to be natural conversation. That's what it's all about.
Of course.
And by the way, Tony, thanks for buying two cars off the platform.
Yes, he did. I mean, Tony, God, what an interesting character. But yeah, he bought two cars. He had a great experience, actually. He did actually text me saying he had a great experience. And I think he's definitely sold one of them on, maybe he sold both, actually. But that's an interesting flip as well, that dealers, I'm sure he's not the first, are looking at collecting cars going, oh, I wonder if they've got interesting stock. I wonder what I can, pick up. And
no, well, look, we're selling cars for private people, mm-hmm. dealers,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we're having our buyers are private people and dealers. It's not quite 50-50, but it's
sure.
It could be something around that. It changes from day to day. And why shouldn't they? You've got to be committed to the process. So if you're a private guy and you're hovering over the mouse to bid with a minute to go and you're a bit nervous, then that's where a dealer comes into their own, because they're not nervous. They can see the pictures. They know what they're buying. Bid, go. We want to legitimize what we're doing. We do appreciate that the online world can be pretty dark and scary for some people.
But
that's why we're doing this podcast. You can see who I am. Chris is involved. This is a
credibility.
This is a proper business. We're not. We feel we are. Very transparent. We're very contactable. Call us. Call the owners. Ask the questions. You've got 7 days. Look at 150 photos. We're not trying to hide anything. We want this experience to be super easy for everyone.
I think the thing with social media now is there is no hiding. And people often forget it, but also it can be a bit... So I feel like sometimes people trust me too much. I feel like sometimes people just go, oh, but it sounds like there's nothing going on. And fine, I'm not trying to hide anything or rip anyone off or whatever, but I could so easily because people
that's
are just
good
like,
to know.
Yeah. So watch out, guys. It's just one of those weird things where social media, it's made everyone more accessible and it's made brands have to be a lot more aware of their presence and what they're doing and be accountable for things. And so interesting that you say that it's a good tactic and probably an important tactic. That from day one there have been names or faces that people could think that they could hold accountable if something went wrong, or at least come and ask questions, or say, look, I'm thinking about doing this X, Y, and Z. But to move on a bit to the more general car chat, because of the range of stuff that you've got on there, what I'm interested by is that things like 812 Superfast, 720Ss, Huracans, etc., seem to be changing hands a lot more often these days, and maybe not for these kind of crazy premiums that they were 2 or 3 years ago.
In general.
I think. I think the platform is great because I think what it does is it highlights probably real values, true values. And so it gets rid of somebody going, oh yeah, my 720, oh, no, 720 is a bad example. My Murcielago is worth 210 grand when, let's not kid ourselves, it's worth 160. And so I think it stops those privateers trying to get these crazy figures and gives us a bit more of a realistic look at the market. And so 911 Speedster, as you said, you ended up paying over for afterwards, not as much as you originally offered. But do you see that moving forward now, that's kind of dead in the market of a performante hurricane boogie 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 actually is not going to be something that can, you know, you can flip so easily these days?
Look, that we know that's changed, and it's still changing, and I think it's a dangerous game to play.
Very dangerous game to play. The one that scares me is that AMG Black Series that just came out at £330,000.
And how many are they making?
God knows. Who cares?
Yeah.
I mean,
it looks good. It looks good.
Great.
Very interesting launch strategy.
Shows
the changing of the guard, perhaps.
I think kind of amazing and great for him. And yeah, changing of the guard, sure, but I don't remember many launch videos that had journalists in anyway. Mm. So it's a weird thing. I mean, it's sort of like, what? Like, Tim, hi. Yeah. But I think cool. And I say great vindication for him because he's done a lot of hard work to get to that point, especially with Mercedes. But that car is one of those ones where I thought, with everything going on in the world and with the market and everything, surely you would have thought maybe this should be 250 grand, not 330. Yeah. It just seems unrealistic.
It's kind of irrelevant because they're all going to be sold. I'm 100%. Sure some will be flipped for a profit. If they've charged too much for them, we're going to find out pretty quickly what the market value is for them. The volume does matter. You say, who cares? Well, I don't really care, but it is a bearing. You know, if they make 10 cars at 310 grand, they're going to be worth £1 million.
Sure,
if they make 1,000 cars, they're probably going to be worth 250 grand. So it has a big bearing. You know, Ferrari are playing a very different game because they're not telling you how many they're building. And I can pretty much tell you, anyone that wanted a piece to coupe has got a piece to coupe.
Oh, as you can see, if you drive down Sloane Street on a Saturday, you'll find that out very quickly.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, and Porsche have done the same. And I don't blame the manufacturers, by the way, because they're not guaranteeing premiums for people. That's not the game they're playing. If you want a Pista and they're in business, they'll be like, let's make enough Pistas for them.
Go
let's make
it.
Enough Gen 2 GT3 RSs for them, for the market. Yeah.
Exactly. If the demand is there, why wouldn't you as a manufacturer?
I think the one difference I would say with those two particular cars is that, you know, a fully spec Pista could be 350 grand and a fully spec GT3 RS is still 190 or 180,000 pounds. And Porsche have kept pretty sensible with the retail value of their cars. So fine, the more cars they make, the premium might not be there, but the residual of a GT product Porsche is still pretty good.
And I don't want to turn this into like Porsche fanboy podcast, but it's so true because, I mean, I guess apart from 992 Turbo S, which just feels a bit too much, but historically, even if you look at a 997 Carrera S, like the values are still so strong. Realistic, you know, what was I looking at the other day? Oh, 991 GTS, so the naturally aspirated GTS, they're still up at like 80 or 90 grand for low mileage ones. It's nuts. And there's very few. I mean, even Ferrari, I think, has softened off a bit recently, at least from what I've seen on 360 and 430 level.
General residuals.
I think just, you know, especially, you know, I watch Challenge Stradales, I watch Scuds, and I watch 360s, and they all seem to have softened off a bit from a couple of years ago. But Porsche just seem to continue to be rock solid in every game, which is, you know, great for Carrera T values, people. But if you've ticked sort of Porsche box, what... Are there cars that you've regretted selling, or are there cars on your I would love to experience owning lists? Because you must have been spoiled over the years.
I bought a 911R at the beginning of this year.
The black one with the
black... one with the silver wheels.
Oh.
And I sold it in the second week of lockdown, and I had quite a lot of inventory that I owned just before lockdown. And so I set myself a task. I want to sell everything.
Let's clear it out.
And I sold everything.
Well done.
Everything I owned, I sold. And I regret selling the 911R.
Yeah.
But there's a story attached to Dick Lovett why I bought that 911R. And I probably bought it for the wrong reasons. So
okay.
we'll probably go full circle and I'll end up with a black 911R.
That was a particularly incredible spec, actual 911R. And I was shocked with the R, how different it was from GT3 Touring. Because I drove the R first and then the Touring. And when I got in the Touring, I expected to do whatever. Oh, it's just better in every single way. But there's something still about R which is just a bit more special.
Yeah.
Something, you know, inherently a bit more exciting. Maybe it's the badge or...
It drives differently. It
drives differently, doesn't it?
Chris would tell you something different.
Oh, okay, classic.
He didn't get an R and he's got a Touring. So.
He's got a Touring. I saw him on the A4 or the Hammersmith flyover a couple of weeks ago, driving a bit too quickly. And he's yellow. I saw this thing come flying. I was like, yellow Touring going quite quickly? I wonder who that could be. I preferred the R, and I saw that car when you listed it and thought, oh, that's brilliant. Because I'm sure I saw it parked up. Did it used to live in central London? Was it a central London car?
I think it probably did.
I think I saw it around and about. Okay, so 911R, anything else? And there's another Porsche.
I've been lucky enough to own several F40s, but they've never really been mine. Yes, they were mine because my money bought the car, but I bought them in with my business head on. And so at some stage where I don't need to use my business head, that is a car that I will own and keep forever and use it and drive it and never care about the mileage.
That over a Carrera GT?
That over a Carrera GT.
Okay.
Not because it's better. It's just for me,
it represents so much.
It does. And I will own another Singer for sure.
Okay.
I've bought and sold about 10 the last 12 months since I sold mine.
Really?
I bought and sold about 10 cars. Some of them not quietly, but people know I know the value of one. So if they need a check written out quickly, I'll write a check out for a Singer. I've done very well with those, but since I sold the Monaco commission, I haven't had my own one, and I'll definitely go back there again.
And selling a Singer, and this is, I guess, brings us onto the weird world of Koenigseggs and Paganis and things like that. Every Singer is bespoke, essentially, right? You know, commissioned with all the details, essentially. And you can tell me if I'm wrong, but I guess done by the owner, or maybe with help from the Singer team. And they're just beautiful to look at. But does that mean that they dictate different values? Because if someone's gone for a Viola purple paint and orange interior, that might not be for everybody.
There's not many out there that are totally, totally crazy, but actually the crazier they are from a blue with tan car, for me, makes it even better.
And I feel like that's the team at Singer have been good at that. You know,
so
keeping
I sold
that.
The Moscow commission, which was violet with white and purple inside. Ooh. And it was four-wheel drive, and I sold it for a Russian friend of mine. It was called the Moscow commission. It was registered in Malta. It was the car with a snowboard rack on the roof.
Okay.
And I sold it to a French guy living in Japan.
Brilliant.
And he inquired on it. We negotiated for about 5 minutes. He bought it.
Brilliant. Yeah. Okay. So
there's someone for everything out there with, especially with Singer.
But that's so, as you know, PTS and MSO, but as I say, Koenigsegg and Pagani really focus on individualization and allowing their customers to go these crazy levels of bespoke. My question is, how does that look on the used market? And maybe some of these guys aren't thinking about that. They don't care. They're rich enough that who gives? But the amount of these cars that I see that are so bespoke, so specific, and Schmee's a good example of that. You know, his cars, when he's speccing them from factory, especially things like the Senna, that's a Schmee car.
Yeah.
Some people will like that.
Kind of. There's some very radical Sennas out there.
Yeah, good point.
I think there might be one for sale up north with lime green leather and stuff like that.
Oh my God.
And, you know.
His is relatively safe in comparison.
Exactly. Some of the Sennas, look brilliant. Others...
horrible. I actually don't think any of them look brilliant, but I mean, fair enough, each their own.
But you say, you know, like some of the Koenigseggs, I think Pagani have done pretty well to keep those
looking
mostly
good,
tasteful. It's a weird market out there. And the circle of those buyers is very small.
Very inbred as well.
Yeah.
You know, they all like Koenigsegg Club, often are the Pagani Club as well, and then they often ship cars in between each other. But I just... I would worry, especially with the rise of social media, because I feel like those highly bespoke cars, those highly individual cars, then become quite social media famous. If I was in that market, I don't know if I would have the appeal, but like, oh, well, that's David's car. I don't want that. Or, oh, there's Brian's car. And, oh, I didn't. But because I'm not in that world, yeah, I don't know. Yeah. It's not like an F40 where you can just go and get a resale red one and be done with it.
No, I don't really get that world. And, you know, I've got a black with black. Yeah. I'm on speed, I can sort of skulk around pretty quietly without being noticed. I'm not one. And funny enough, when I spec the Singer, I knew I wanted Porsche Midnight Blue as the exterior colour. And then the inside, I wanted something with some personality. So when it's parked on the street, it's just an old blue 911 for 98% of the people that walk past. I even had every Singer badge taken off. So If you know, you know. So I'm not one for being too
big and shouty. Yeah. Come and meet my 360.
Wait till I get my yellow Rolls Royce Dawn.
I'd love to see you. In a,
I don't. Funny enough, actually, just going. These are not sort of dream cars, but three kids, two dogs, wife, Singer is Singer Speedster. They're all very impractical because I can't get anyone in. So The car that I'll probably buy at some point in my life is a Mercedes 1971 floor shift Mercedes 3.5 SE convertible.
So this is where you need Chris, because I have no idea what that is.
Yeah, a beautiful, big, huge, wagon-y, hand-built, convertible Mercedes.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, there is an amazing something like that that cruises around Belgravia in like a, it's either silver or blue.
Yeah, it will be one of those.
One of those,
yeah.
Okay. It's okay, so that's Graham the ultimate
friend. It's probably Graham Hunt smoking around, yeah.
I mean, you say the Speedster and the Singer are impractical. I'm not sure that Mercedes would be that practical because I feel like it's going to be broken down on the M4 somewhere.
No, I think it's... No,
you think
it'd
be all right?
Good cars, but sure. Practical, so I can get my kids in it.
Yeah, with the roof down.
Yeah, a Sunday brunch car.
I think it's a bit of a squinty practicality there. Well, look, we're gonna sort of wrap things up. If you had sort of one motivating factor to tell people to go and check out collecting cars. I mean, it's felt like a bit of a plug for collecting cars, but it is because I enjoy the platform and you're kind enough to have me on the podcast. So yeah, what would you say is one motivating factor for people to go have a look?
Yeah, look, I don't want to feel like I need to plug it, but you know, come and use the site, you know, list your car with us. It is whatever we're doing, and it's not, it's tactical, but we're not, it's working, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we're getting good prices, more than trade. In some cases, more than retail for the sellers. But in a lot of cases, you're probably saving on what you'd have to pay in a showroom. Sure. You're certainly getting more than a dealer would write a check for you. And it's quick. Yeah. And one thing we didn't really talk about, which is an important thing that collecting cars do, is there are dealers out there that have gone bankrupt that do use the sale or return model that, you know, list your performante with me, I'll charge you $5,000 plus the VAT or whatever it is. The buyer pays for the performante, and the owner never gets the money.
There's been a
big auction house that's gone down. So with collecting cars, the car stays with the owner.
Okay.
We host the auction, and post-auction, the buyer pays the seller and goes and collects the car. So it's a very safe way of selling as well.
Okay. Well, look, there you go, guys. I do recommend it. Even if, like me, you're not necessarily looking to buy, but you do cruise Auto Trader.
If you're a voyeur.
If you're a voyeur. Collecting cars is slightly better than Auto Trader if you're an enthusiast, just to go and have a look at. But my final shout is that I think at some point we're going to have to arrange a shoot with your Speedster and Chris's touring. That'll be my next plug. but thank you very much for taking time. I really appreciate it. For all of you listening, if you want to check out Collecting Cars, links are below. You can find Ed as well on various social medias with International Collectibles, Collecting Cars, etc. And I'll be catching up with you guys again very, very soon. So goodbye.
Thank you very much. Cheers, Sam.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.